Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Times and places.
Copyright Deskin 1979.
Faithful sisters, and welcome to episode 165 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
And I'm Mark.
And in this podcast, you'll hear very little of us apart from the introduction, because this is the interview which Mark and I conducted with Deskin and Gareth Cavanagh at Capital 5 on the 2nd and 3rd of April. This year. It's about an hour long, but we think it's worth listening to. Gareth, of course, heavily involved with the wonderful Warp Warp and with Cutaway Comics. And Des, Mark?
Des started off as a comic fanzine printer and producer and publisher when he was a teenager, and ended up helping launch the careers of people like Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, quite big figures in British comics. And he went on to edit, well, I think he wrote for some as well, Core, Wizard and Chips, Buster, stuff like that. Basically working for Fleetway Publishing. After Fleetway Publications bit, he also worked for British Marvel Publishing. He produced the Hulk Comic Weekly for Marvel UK, and then went on to produce Doctor Who Weekly, which obviously then was became Doctor Who Monthly, which became Doctor Who Magazine, which is still going now.
So, two big guys in the comics world, or at least it's certainly in our comics world. We spent Friday, Mark and I, in the bar at the hotel, looking around surreptitiously for a shaven-headed man with a small beard, which was going to look like Deskin. And if we'd known that he was going to turn up dressed as Terry Pratchett, it would be a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Terry, I think, was one of his heroes, isn't he?
Yes, I believe so, yes. One of the fun things when we were chatting to Deskin, and when you went up to get your, what did you buy? You bought a copy of his Worlds of Who?
Oh, that was it.
Comic, was it?
I think it was one of the, or did he run out of the originals, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, and a mock-up of the original Doctor Who Weekly that he pitched to Marvel.
Issue zero, yes.
Yes, issue zero. And you got them signed. He signed them hap-tap in yours, didn't he? Because you remember the letter from the Doctor in Doctor Weekly that used to finish with Happy Times and Places.
Copyright Des Skin 1979.
Well, that wasn't the Doctor, it was Des Skin writing that. And it was him who coined the phrase Happy Times and Places.
Copyright Des Skin 1979.
And he's mildly furious how much Tom Baker and other people use that phrase now, and he gets no credit for it. So, Happy Times and Places.
Copyright Des Skin 1979.
Is copyright Des Skin. And if you get anything signed from him, and it says Hap Tap, that's what it means.
Des Tarts been very unexpectedly down to earth and chatty. And Gareth, of course, has long been a friend of the podcast. You'll have to forgive the occasional background noises. Mark and I found what we thought was an ideal little niche of a sofa and a couple of armchairs to record in. And only when we got well into the interview did we realise that we were right next to the hotel restaurant area and people were coming around setting the tables. So you'll hear some clattering of silverware and banging of cups and saucers. But if you do hear a bit of conversation in the background, far from a distraction, that's a privilege. Because that is the family of the great Terence Dicks, who joined us at the Capitol that weekend. So, interview's just about an hour long, and we'll start it now. Well, we're here at the Capitol on Sunday morning, and we're joined by long-time friend of the show, Mr. Gareth Gavanna, and new friend of the show, although he doesn't know it, Mr. Deskin.
Whoever he is.
Happen, gentlemen.
Happen, yeah.
Now
then. We're both Northerners, so it's going to
well,
be a lot
Northerners.
Of...
Well, he's a Northerner.
Now then,
Manchester
here,
royalty.
Yeah, you've got a bit down south from 30 Hull. Years, so you
wouldn't
from Hull.
See that? Yeah. East Yorkshire. By gum.
Half Welsh, half
so
Northern.
We're going to lose most of the audience, Gavin, because you can't do subtitles on podcasts. So no. You're buggered.
No, it's not going to be any surprise to the three of us or to the audience that my expertise on comics is as nothing compared to Mark's. So Mark, for once in a lifetime, I'm going to shut up on this podcast.
Are you?
It's also to say something controversial.
Yes.
Now you've put it on the spot.
Yeah, you have.
Go on, so now, you need a Johnny Balloon
We aren't scripted. Right. Do you think Cutaway Comics would exist without their skin?
No.
Because am I right in saying that essentially what you've done is taken the idea of the backup strip from Doctor Who Weekly and expanded it, as in it's a doctorless universe?
Yes.
So without Des?
Without Des, none of this happens.
I've got a lot to answer for.
The genius that Des had was to realise that you can tell a different story without the Doctor. The Doctor's great, yeah, especially when he's played by Tom Baker on top Winton style, but the problem is you can't do anything really to the Doctor in the process of that story. You can't develop the character. The Doctor starts and finishes the story broadly in the same place and everything moves around is one thing. The other thing is that the Doctor's generally only there for about 8 to 12 hours. It's not even a holiday. It's like a stopover in an airport where he turns everything upside down and buggers off and leaves the world to it. And I remember thinking... And this is something that Des did, that if the Doctor isn't there, the universe has to kind of muddle through and the endings, you'd agree, are not usually, they're not as neat and tidy, are they? They're not as happy.
No, that which was something that the BBC were a bit disappointed with.
We saw it in the paperwork, didn't we?
We were looking at the paperwork because they may have wiped loads of Doctor episodes, but that bureaucracy of the BBC kept all of the paperwork.
What paperwork?
Memos between Marvel Comics and Nathan Turner.
Oh,
and BBC Enterprise.
It was like a marriage on the rocks. Every email got bitchier and bitchier. This was after I left. While I was there, it was perfect. I'd go up and the only time I saw the Beeb was when I'd take printed copies up. There was none of this approval malarkey. Because I always had this belief that if you license your property, your baby to somebody, it's not just about the money. It's about knowing that that licensee is going to do a good job and really help promote your brand.
Yeah.
Because the money doesn't go far, not from a comics company, but if you can just help boost the property, it's in the licensor's interest. Something I did with House of Hammer as well. I just didn't know that their next film and last film was going to be Mutiny on the Buses, which we didn't adapt.
You did cut a very mean deal, though, Des, when we looked at the deal. It must be a savvy deal maker, this
one. For which one? House of...
No. For Doctor Who Weekly.
Oh, for Doctor Who Weekly.
2.5%. Can we say that?
We can.
Oh, yeah. I did.
We can. But 2.5% is the top line. Once all your clearances had come off...
Oh, yes!
It was nearer about 0.8%.
Less clearances.
Huh. And there's some memos where the BBC tweaked this.
But it was about 8 years later.
Oh. Someone goes, hang on a minute, this is supposed to be a dreadful deal.
So that's 2.8%.
What?
2.8%, what's that?
2.5% of
cover price.
On copies sold, not even
or
on
goes
print.
To the BBC. Oh. Yeah.
That's what they would get.
Ooh, less so deduction.
We didn't send it through the post because the cost of the stamp would have wiped out their royalty.
Well, that suggests what you've been saying, isn't it? That they weren't taking it seriously.
They weren't.
That they weren't taking the idea of
what could
really be done seriously.
They didn't really understand how publishing went.
No, there was no BBC publications back then. You've got to appreciate, yes, it really was life on Mars in 1979. It was a different world. The fact that I got the license just like that was phenomenal, I thought.
I imagine a world of oak panels and globe drinks cabinets where you walk in and there's a nice sort of smell of lavender in the air. And you know,
Ian Lavender, is that? Ian Lavender. Yeah, the nice smell of Ian Lavender.
And then, you know, the gin and the varietals are there. Like you imagine, you know, the staff
room. Imagine the Diddy Dum podcast
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, like you imagine the Diddy Dum podcast. Or the staff room from Mr. Chips.
Yes, yes.
This is jolly good stuff, Des.
And it was like that, because I would turn up once a week at BBC Enterprise in Langham House. And I'd say, here you go, there's a half a dozen copies of the latest issue. And Roy Williams would say, gin and tonic.
Oh, marvellous.
And we'd just spend the next few hours getting...
Few hours? it was quite a big drinking culture at the BBC at the time, wasn't it?
Well, Graham Williams was running the production, so right. Say no more.
Okay.
Had Douglas Adams like that.
I believe he did.
Yeah. But they were all big fellas. And they had hollow legs, didn't they?
Go West me Douglas Adams anecdotes on this podcast.
I think we should.
Yes. Yes, please do.
Oh, yeah. We'll always. It's good that you have it registered anyway to take out the ums and ahs. So if anything goes wrong, we can always.
Right. So, because one thing I've learned as an editor, is a lesson for you, is you have to think in paragraphs. If you are to write in paragraphs, there is no time for first drafts and second drafts in the real world.
Mm.
Did you notice what I did there? I paused.
Yes.
That was a paragraph break.
Oh.
And there was another one. If you think that way.
Yeah.
He's actually used it already.
Is that Peter's brother?
Aye. Rudy used it off. It's the lesser brother, you know, from all.
If you think in paragraphs, you can type very quickly, and your first draft is finished. I, for instance, never have done first and second drafts. I've maybe occasionally changed the odd adjective where I've duplicated myself, but that's pretty much been it, because it's a discipline you have to have. Paragraph break.
Right.
Dot, 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 and I have.
It's almost like a verbal version. Sometimes you'll see, it's like a Doctor Who episode, and you'll think, that doesn't make sense. I wonder if they just, for lengthwise, they'd cut out a 1 minute scene. And obviously, this is a more visual sense of it. And if it had been edited more properly, they would have realised we can't cut that scene out because it means that nothing makes sense.
Everything falls to
pieces. Well, Flux was that.
Yeah.
You see that Flux was a 10 part series that they scrunched into six. So the Grand Serpent guy and the unit stuff, which they obviously quite liked, didn't go anywhere, and it just, you could have lost it, and that was the bits that should have gone, but I suppose they didn't want to check out all the lovely things.
Have you been watching the latest series of Doctor Who at all?
Not, I wouldn't use the word avidly.
No, right, okay.
I would use the word occasionally, on catch-up of some form.
Yeah.
I used to eagerly look forward to transmission and watch it live.
Oh, of the new series?
Of the Eccleston, Tennant, Smith. Because my daughter was of that classic catch 'em while they're young age. And I think from 8 to 14, if that's the right span for what I just described, she was a huge Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
But she couldn't understand why they then cast an old man.
And yes, a lot of people said that.
Yes. A lot of people did, because they'd suddenly got the youth audience. They'd got sexy. And the whole idea of Doctor Who being sexy.
Oh, yeah, they'd done two handsome young guys, hadn't they? And
If you said to Troughton or to Pertwee, you know, we want sexy. And maybe Pertwee was sexy in a strange way. But
strangely sexy.
It can be sexy. But I don't think you realise that
until
you're much older.
I'm sure his mother.
But I'm just thinking, if you say springe, that's an entirely different subject to come on to a word like that.
Right. So if you were doing Doctor Who Weekly with Peter Capaldi as the lead,
yes,
what would you have done?
If I was doing Doctor Who Weekly with Peter Capaldi, it wouldn't really matter, quite honestly, because the way we dealt with it...
You'd fill it with David Tennant.
No, not so much. No, I think a good writer comes up with a damn fine story and then inject the Doctor into it. Because if you do it the other way around, you end up with very shallow storytelling. If you come up with a damn fine story and then say, now, and how would the Doctor fit into this? And then the showrunner puts all the little details and continuity in so that you've got a slightly bigger crack in the wall or whatever it might be, you know. I think that's a good way of working, and I think that's an important role that is often overlooked with the showrunner. You often hear writers criticising the fact they've been rewritten. Well, they're not coming down from the mountain and set in stone. These are not the Ten Commandments, and I'm afraid a showrunner runs the show, and it's his head on the chopping block, not the freelance writers, and I think he has every right to edit.
Mm.
Says an editor.
Yes. By the way, in case people are thinking, we haven't edited out the Douglas Adams anecdote.
It's waiting. Well, this is my Ronnie Corbett moment. We will get back to it.
Yeah, you need a higher stool. In a manner of speaking.
Now, before we get to Ronnie Corbett, I know something I've never asked you. One of my favourite parts of Dr. Weekly was the crazy captions.
Oh, good God.
Yeah, there were some crackers in there. Who judged those? You picked the photos, obviously.
Obviously, yes.
Obviously. And you kind of had an idea what you were... Yeah. Did you have a caption in mind when you picked the photo?
Oh, some are screaming out for it, aren't they, really? And it's often sad when nobody gets it. You've got the perfect joke in your head for that crazy caption. I don't believe we're doing crazy captions. Mm. And nobody comes up with the perfect joke.
But there was no crazy caption in House of Hammer, though, was there?
No, because it wasn't Famous Monsters of Film Land.
Yeah, no, I had those bubblegum cards from Universal Pictures Monsters and stuff with really terrible
jokes
on them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had a set of them on.
And the interesting story I heard, and we are going so tangential here, so apologies, you can speed forward.
No, a listener's totally used
to that. That's our thing.
with Famous Monsters, a lot of the criticism and... something I didn't get. I took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Famous Monsters thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
So they would always have a really bad pun. Mm.
Sort of Dracula pull my Boris, finger joke or something like
Boris
that.
Boris Karloff or...
Yeah.
I mean, Fory Ackerman would put his name... He was ahead of his time in this respect as Fory Ackerman. And but it was so full of puns because his publishers had said to him, we want you to imagine... I'm your audience and I'm a 9-year-old boy. Make me laugh.
Mm.
Well, that's not a good origin story for a film magazine about horror, is it, really? You know. So I just thought, well, don't write down to your readers and don't write over their heads. Pitch it so it doesn't matter whether they're 8 or 18, there'll be something that will work for them. And with Doctor Who magazine or Doctor Who Weekly, I didn't call it a comic or a magazine because it was a hybrid. And I thought all those kids who'd stopped reading the Beano and Dandy, but they understood the medium because comics is a medium, it's not a genre. And it's a medium that there are those who don't understand it because it's quite surreal. The idea of people walking around with speech balloons over their heads. You have to actually understand the rhythm of a comic to be able to read it. That you're looking at the pictures subliminally while you're reading the words. And you're reading them in different voices, and all the action happens in between the frames. You link it all together in your head and make it animated. A lot of people can't do that. There was a book programme on Radio 4 or whatever where they decided to review a graphic novel, Watchmen. And of the four people to give reviews, two of them admitted they couldn't read comics.
Oh.
Isn't that strange?
That's interesting.
I do hope so.
Russell T Davies being interested, interviewed back a while when he was still the showrunner, and he was talking about how many people in the television industry, production industry, say, I don't watch television.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Tom Baker says this. When the only time I met Tom Baker, I was like the bag carrier at a private signing, so we had an hour with him. And luckily, because I produced theatre, he was interested in me. For a change, he just said, I'm a slavering fat. He's not bothered. Mm. I produce theatre.
That's the sort of thing.
And I said, you know, what do you watch on the box? I'm genuinely interested in that. And he said, I don't watch anything. Nothing. So I read books, I don't have enough time. He said, but my wife watches telly, and she tells me about it. So he said, so if anyone asks me, what are you watching? He said, I always answer. And I'm pretty sure that Toaster's nicked this. He goes, I hear Breaking Bad's jolly good. And I hear the wire is tremendous. and then he says, they're happy. He said, no one quizzes me on what my favourite episode of The Wire is. They're just happy that he's still engaged with this medium.
Lovely.
But he's not. But,
no.
But his wife tells him all about it. So right. He has this kind of audio-described version of The Sopranos, which might be quite good.
So, but our RTD was talking about people who are writing television and producing it and directing it to say things that I don't want. To, as if you're, it's always beneath them. It's like saying, oh, I don't read comics. As
Oh, well, we're looking at Russell T. Davis does read comics.
Yes.
He was very literate.
Grew up on my stuff.
He did?
Yeah.
And
quite a few people have grown up on your stuff.
I believe so. I think a certain Mr. Tennant might have as well.
Yeah.
And Mark Gatiss, didn't he say?
Yeah, Mark.
You had a big a fan moment with him.
Oh, well, every event we're both at, he'll come over to me and have a chat with me. I mean, the first time he did it, I didn't know who he was. And, you're the guy at the League of Gentlemen.
Simon Pegg, another...
Simon Pegg, he's a big fan. I'm his spiritual godfather.
No.
We were saying about Tom, though. One funny moment I remember was when we were launching Doctor Who Weekly. I was very lucky in that Tom and I went on the road together. And we visited all these awfully dull places like W.H. Smith's house, Island Dudley. And we were offering cucumber sandwiches and glasses of wine to the retailers.
Wedges of Doctor Who.
And they all turned up because there was going to be an actor there.
Mm.
And I did all the talking. I know that's a bit of a shock. But and Tom just grinned manically at them. And
was he in costume, do you remember?
Oh, yes, of course he was. Okay. He was the doctor. He wasn't Tom Baker.
Hmm.
And we ended up in Brighton. At coincidentally, there was the World Science Fiction Convention on during the week of our launch. The World Science Fiction Convention in 1979 called SeaCon, because it was by the sea. I was in Brighton, so they could have called it BCon, but they settled on SeaCon. And we were there. And talking about some people can't read comics and such. These were fans of science fiction literature.
Mm.
They read books without pictures. Tom and I were among the guests. We were the worst of the worst because we were both television and comics. We weren't books. They had Ray Bradbury there and Isaac Asimov. And
that's right, I've seen the guest list for that con. And Douglas Adams is like almost at the bottom.
Yeah.
This would be 79, would it?
Yeah. And Tom and I did a talk, of course, a Q&A.
There's some grainy shots of you holding up Doctor Who Weekly.
That's right.
I have in my hand.
Yeah, a dummy.
Yeah.
And what they had a notice board, because it was a 3 or 4 day event, and every morning there would be clippings from any media coverage and such. And as I say, Tom and I were already the villains of the piece for being the commercial side of science fiction.
Mm.
And one morning, I went in and I was getting such dark looks from everybody because when I discovered the notice board, there'd been a big piece in The Guardian, almost a full page, and this was the full Guardian size, not the strangely shrunken version that we see now. And on a 5-column page, 3 columns to represent CCOM was a photograph of Tom Baker and Des Skin. Instead of Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, and all these lesser mortals. So the sci-fi community, of course they look down their nose at that term anyway, were not happy with us.
Well, yeah, and you know, there's a real-life spin-off to that because that was the convention that, gosh, what's his name? Nigel Neal, the only convention he ever attended. And he found it so horrifying, such a horrific experience. He really hated meeting the fans. He hated everything about it. He went off and wrote Kinvig on the back of that.
About
a fantasist TV repairman who's a huge sci-fi fan and fantasizes about traversing the stars.
Right.
It's a very unkind piece, but that unkindness is definitely there in Nigel Neal's work. There's a curmudgeonly anti-youth spirit in it. But yes, I think you and Tom probably put the seal on it for him.
I would think so, because he hated Doctor Who, didn't he?
The writer of that Guardian article probably means is what you've been saying is that they know that that's going to sell.
The commercial face of the medium.
A beaming Tom Baker.
Is television and comet.
Mm.
I'm sorry, books. You know.
And you can be as satisfying as you like, but if no one wants to buy it, no one's going to find out. I was just thinking when you said that, oh, well, you know, in the garden used to be the right size. I remember my grandma lighting a fire. I put a sheet of broadsheet paper against
that,
and then put the shovel against it.
Not possible with the
drawer. So it'll draw, that's
not possible.
That morning, in fact, a Guardian link, Tom Baker, Doctor Who story. Eh?
Yeah.
That morning, I went down for breakfast, or the next morning, I went down for breakfast, and I looked around the room of Tom, and I saw this Guardian newspaper with this massive hair over the top of it. And I thought, well, that's obviously Tom. So I went over and I sat down opposite him, so I got my coffee. I went, morning, Tom. And it's a shame there's no visuals for this, because the newspaper slowly came down, revealing more of his bushy hair, until it got to his eyes, which, if you recall, are quite piercing.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't go any lower down than that. And then this voice boomed out. Are you a fan of cricket, Des? I went, not really. And the newspaper slowly went back up again. And that was our breakfast conversation.
So who else did you meet at that convention then? With all them? Was there anyone you wanted to meet? Because you were a fan of sci-fi and all those things. There must have been some names that you thought, great heroes of yours that you would like to have a cup of tea with, Garibaldi.
Funny you should mention that. That's how politicians start, isn't it? Because I'm going to say something totally relevant to your question. Neil Gaiman at the time was a fanboy who wasn't really getting any of his writing in print, except interviewing science fiction authors to be the words that go between the colour pages in Fiesta and Knave.
The articles. Right. People say, I buy them for the articles.
Yes, exactly. I buy them for the sci-fi interviews. Gosh,
I'm pretty sure a friend of mine once brought a copy of Knave for the interview with Fish von Marillion.
Oh.
There we are, you see.
So there we go.
And that's his cover story.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was where
Neil
got his,
was there.
Neil so did Ray Bradbury know he was going in the pages of Knave?
That's a really good question. I mean, maybe Knave sounds like an okay title to an American. It's not like Biggin's Monthly, is it?
Mayfair's got a classiness to it as well, hasn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
Playboy. Very British.
It is, yeah.
Playboy is a bit of a playboy, isn't he? Mm-hmm. I mean, they used to give them much more clever titles than they do now, if they still exist.
Yes, no one ever does that on The Apprentice. Your task this week is to come out with a new Razzle Mag for the British.
Okay, Douglas Adams. So, at CECON, a lot of people from around the world arrive because this is the World Science Fiction Convention, and people knew that Tom was going to be there. And there are these, shall we call them, Whovian groupies, and the ones from California are rather nice. And one,
so they were looking to complete their sticker album.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah.
Got to collect them all.
Yes.
So there were two of them there, and one of them was particularly attractive, the other one was her friend. And I got in conversation with this particularly attractive one. And I don't know if I said it deliberately to impress her or what, but I said, I've got to go off and have dinner with Tom Baker in a minute. You know. And she said, can I come? Well, I don't know what possessed me. But I said, I said, hang on, I'll find out. So I sought out Tom and I said, this is rather nice young lady from California. Can she come to dinner with us, Tom, do you think? And he went, I don't think that would be appropriate. So I said, I'll be back after dinner. You can't come with us, but I'll be back after dinner. I went off to have dinner with Tom and I did skip dessert, I think. And I came back down. Is this what your podcast is?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, so I came back down and I saw her friend was still there. And I went over and I said, where's Mary Beth or Barbara Ann or whatever strangely hyphenated names they have over there? And she said, she got fed up of waiting for you, so she went off with Douglas Adams instead.
Oh.
The next time I bumped into Douglas, I didn't mention it because you don't, do you? Mm. You don't say, you bastard, beating me to the punchline. You don't mention it. I saw him in San Diego at Comic-Con, and it's a big hall. And I'm walking in one direction, he's walking in the other, and we're sort of heading towards each other. And we knew each other.
And he's enormous and gangling, isn't he?
Mm. Gangling, good word. Yes, he's gangling.
You could spot him for, a few stories.
You could. And I said to him, what are you doing here? Oh, don't tell me you're going to make a comic book of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't want to overexpose it. I said, no, of course not. Not beyond the towel, the paperback, the radio play, the sequel, the TV series, the film. I completely understand. There you go. There's my Douglas Adams moment.
Thank you.
What was he like as a man, though? Was he
pompous?
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't go exactly where I was going. Yeah. I didn't go to university. I fought my way up the work ladder.
You were a chemist, weren't you?
I was a research
industrial
chemist.
Yeah.
Yes, and I do sometimes find that these university graduates do think they're a little bit superior to the rest of us, which of course they are. And we're very humble, and we touch our forelocks. Those of us who still have forelocks to touch.
You're friends with a chap, or you were friends with a chap, sadly passed now, who's one of the biggest TV and comic nerds that we know of, Bob Monkhouse.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah.
How did you...
I was going to talk at the ICA, and I heard a laugh where somebody had cracked a joke on stage, and the laugh from the person next to me was so identifiable, because Bob Monkhouse had a very identifiable laugh.
Well, he's on one of the biggest TV shows, was that around Golden Shot time?
It could well have been, yeah.
Or Family Fortunes?
No, I think it would have been Golden Shot. But anyway, the point is, I don't know how we ended up sort of bonding, but we became really good chums. Mm. And he was living at the time in Maida Vale, and I'd go to his place. He was a lovely bloke, and I think a lot of people misunderstood him because he was so damn clever that he seemed a bit too slick. He had the perfect answer to everything within a nanosecond. That ability should be applauded. Yeah. But funnily enough, it was resented because he was too clever. Maybe I'm back to my university graduates again. But with him,
he was very much not a slapstick comic, was he? So his jokes would
quick fire
turn on a single phrase. Yeah.
How many other comedians do you think of?
Yeah.
Well, we could have done a TV series where the audience would ask them questions and they'd give you an instant gag.
Yeah.
Very brave.
We owe him a great deal as well, because without Bob and the court case that he fought, we wouldn't have home video recordings, because we wouldn't have anything like that. So thanks to him, much stuff exists.
What was it he did?
Well, he had his marvellous collection of 16mm films and early video recordings. And the law as it stood, as it's interpreted by the Crown Prosecution Service, said, these are illegal recordings, you're not the copyright holder, you cannot have them, these must be destroyed. And they were going to have all of his entire life's collection. He had rare silence, seized and burnt in the late 70s. And luckily, he had the foresight and the strength and the money to fight them.
Yes.
And they went all the way to the court and they got an interim ruling that then set the precedent that was put into law that you can have recordings for personal pleasure. So if you've bought that 16mm film and you play it for yourself, not for commercial gain, you can have it. If you record, you know, Bridge Over the River Kwai off BBC Two on your VHS, you can have that and you can play it anytime you want. You can't sell it, but you can keep it and record it. Amazing to think that didn't exist.
Which ties in greatly with Doctor Who, because of all of the lost episodes that we've got the audio recordings of.
Well, do you know, there are still collectors out there who have stuff and are terrified the BBC will sue them. Because somebody bought, they've retrieved it from the skip, or they've you know, bought it off someone who retrieved it from the skip, and they feel that even now, even post Monkhouse, that's why a lot of them are very secretive, and they used to cut the leaders off.
I think we as fans, in a slightly getting annoyed about it, think, oh, these tool collectors are doing this out of selfishness, you know, to cock a snoop at us. But actually, he thinks that
they think they're going to be legal consequences. And the BBC isn't very good at communicating these things sometimes. You know, I mean, the guy, you know, the guy with the episode The Crusade from New Zealand, you know, they threatened him with legal action because he was going to auction the film. And, you know, and he'd already returned it, so they'd take a copy. And then finally, someone sensible
and
said...
even after he returned
someone sensible said, all right, you don't own the copyright and stuff on it, but that film can is yours. You can sell it. But it was it took months, so... I think that, that's why I think that fear is still out there. Because a lot of these guys aren't online, so they just... Something that they were told in the 80s, as far as I can see, that's still how it works.
Yeah, those of us of a certain generation used to record Top of the Pops on our little tape recorders. And we all were in fear that we were breaking the law because we were taping something off the top.
Trying to hit the pause button before the DJ
came
on some smart challenge.
Challenge, that was before the
final chords of the song.
Before Jimmy Savile came in.
Well, I remember Dick Finney at BFI telling me, because he does the Missing Believe Wipe. And you get these, and a lot of the Top of the Pops are missing. Huge amount. And he got, and he's got comedy value.
Do you think they've got the paperwork?
They have got the paperwork. All the clearances have got the tapes. And
love it.
Someone I can only imagine as being like Dick Emery's vicar. He got a call off a vicar who, in the '70s, had, for the benefit of his parishioners, recorded only the Pans People sections of Top of the Pops. So he had hours of Pans People.
Pans People, we should explain, were young girls dancing
new
sexily.
New bal dancers. When the artiste wasn't available to play in studio.
Or American.
Or American. So, for the benefit of his parishioners, this marvellous resource was returned to the BFI. And it took dedication, I would imagine, on those early clunky videos to wait for the perfect Pans People clunk.
But Pans People is why all the dads watch Top of the Pops, just waiting for them to come on.
And the vicars.
Frank Highfield. We don't want Frank Highfield and North Harris. And who does?
No.
We want Benny Hill. No, we want Pans People.
We want Pans People.
That was the weirdest thing, though, that what I loved about Top of the Pops and the music back then was it wasn't all segregated. There was one chart. And you could have Benny Hill on Top of the Pops, followed by the Beatles, followed by Charlie Drake.
Yeah. We were saying
it was
this.
A smorgasbord.
We watched the, I think was it the Emmys nominations on the news, and we went, we don't know how they bloody are. And then we bemoaned the loss of Top of the Pops, where for a 25-minute investment of your time, once a week, you could be down with the kids and know what was popular.
It brought everything into focus.
It's very egalitarian, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Although now it would just be, at 29, Ed Sheeran. At 28, Ed Sheeran. You in at 27, Ed Sheeran.
It's like the Beatles were in America in the late 60s, when they suddenly Rush released something like 12 singles, and it just seemed that these guys were geniuses because they came up with 12 songs just like that.
You talk much to Bob Monkhouse about comics.
That's our main conversation. In fact, a little anecdote, as I have been known to do a few of these, with my new book, Says Des, available now. Chock-a-block with anecdotes. Monkhouse does make an appearance, yes. Bob phoned me one day and he said, the Daily Mirror are giving away Garth originals by Frank Bell. So hopefully your audience got how important that was by that wonderful gasp. Thank you for that.
That was a Beano-esque gasp.
It was a Beano-esque gasp, yes. And Bob said, shall we get some? Because he was just like a kid. He was a collector, he was a fan. And I said, that'd be great. I said, look, I'll tell you what. You write to the Daily Mirror because you stand a better chance of blagging it than I do because they'll have heard of you. So he said, yeah, all right. So he wrote to the Daily Mirror to get some Garth originals for a pair of his. And the Daily Mirror's strip editor, I suppose you'd call him, the strip editor, check your gloves off, he sent us two originals as we'd asked for, but they were by Jack Donkley, the Larks, which wasn't quite the same thing, you know. But the Mirror didn't really know the difference between a comedy strip by Jack Donkley and Garth by Frank.
Did you get any George and Linz as well?
No, George and Lynn.
I knew the artist, John Burns.
Oh, right.
He's a mate of mine, yeah. So... I could say, here, knock us off a quick, Lynn, will you?
Yeah. George and Lynn was a short newspaper comic strip that was...
Always ended up with Lynn Toplett.
Yes. It was just a couple talking about, this looks nice, what should we do later on today? I don't know, what do you fancy? We could go to the park. Oh, Lynn
Toplett.
Oh, no,
I'm doing the ironing. Oh, all your clothes have dropped off.
So, we get to interview Des Skin with Gareth, and we end up talking about Bob Monkhouse.
Yes.
Tell us about Des.
What, the book? My new book. Well, I refuse to believe that people have done this, but they constantly said to me, why don't you write your autobiography? And I just think, well, I'm a great catalyst. If anyone asks what my role in life has been, I would say as a catalyst. Mm-hmm. I make things happen. I make Alan Moore known to the world, mm-hmm. by publishing stuff. I make the Starburst, mm-hmm. so suddenly there's a science fiction magazine in this country. Warrior, whatever, I set myself targets, mountains to climb if you wish. And I think it's about the product, it's not about me. The only reason that you've got my name on everything is quite simply editors are invisible, mm-hmm. and easily replaced by cheaper people. Mm-hmm. The trouble with being an editor is you're invisible,
yeah.
and you're thus easily replaced by an assistant who is cheaper than you. So
basically, you splash their skin.
Well, this is where I'm going. Astutely observed, Gareth. So I realised this relatively early on. When I worked at IPC magazines, there were 2,000 journalists. You are a grain of sand. When I moved on from IPC, from Wizard and Chips and Buster Core, where I did get a grounding,
the best.
I learned, I didn't learn much creatively because it was more like the military, but I learned about proofreading and being a sub-editor and production and deadlines and all the stuff that's really dull but awfully important, because you can be the most creative person in the world. But if you don't understand what goes behind that, your stuff doesn't work. Anyway, editors are invisible. No one has ever said to me, that was a damn fine bit of editing you did there, Des. But if you make a mistake,
yes,
they're on you like a pack of hounds.
As we saw in the paperwork.
As we saw in the paperwork when Alan McKenzie misspelt Peter Davidson's last name.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, you saw the paperwork for that?
Oh, yeah. Oh yes.
Oh.
It's wonderful.
What was the response?
We'll get to that.
Well, okay.
There's lots of responses.
I'm promoting my book, if you don't mind.
Of course.
It's merely the build-up.
I apologise, Mr. Comic.
That's a...
the greatest panel ever.
We will not explain that one. But that panel cannot be beaten. No. Even by the missus. So, editors are invisible. And so it's a risky profession. But I thought, well, if I put my name on it, when I go looking for another job, I can say, I did this. And my name isn't Tharg. No. They'll know it was me, because nobody else on the entire planet has as daft a name as I do. I can't owe anyone money because you can find me far too easily. You can't mix me up with 25 other Des Skins. So, I have my name on it.
Mm. Which you can, thank Steve Moore for, actually.
Indeed, when I first came... Well, it goes back to when I went to Hull to college... doing organic chemistry. Yep, that was a career choice. I had a girlfriend over there who I used to go see instead of going to college to do organic chemistry. And in Hull, Derek, which is my real name, gets abbreviated to Des. In London, it's Del. Del. Right. And so she called me Des. And I thought, well, that's way more cool than Derek.
No, I think Del Skin could have worked.
Del Skin. The man from Del Skin.
Del Cells.
Brilliant. So anyway, she called me Des, and I thought that's cool. And I started doing fanzines, and so I signed off as Des Skin. And when I came down to London and started working at IPC magazines, I was introduced to all of the offices, led around the offices by one of the few people I knew, because he'd been doing fanzines in London. I'd been doing them in Yorkshire. And that was Steve Moore. So he didn't introduce me as Derek Skin, because he only knew me through my fanzines, where my fanzine name was Dead Skin.
And it works because it scans. We were saying this last night for dinner. Derek Skin is like one too many syllables. Mm. Des Skin, like, it's like Stan Lee. Like Stanley yes. Lieber. Yeah. There's just too many syllables in there. Des Skin. Del Skin, I think, could have worked as well, although it does sound.
Still you're selling right. me on that now. I'm 71. I'm not going to start all over again.
Our Del.
Our Del. So anyway, yes, so I believe, though, that people were buying my products. And if I was replaced, I'm not vain enough to think that the sales would drop. Although Doctor Who Weekly could prove me wrong. And a lot of people have said, well, you've done all these amazingly absurd things. You know, jumping out of airplanes, crashing a car at 70 miles an hour, going to Hawaii, going to casinos in Kuala Lumpur.
Studio 54.
Of course. A story we did the other day. Tough. Sorry. And they said, you've got to do it, you've got to write it down. And one of my favourite performing artists, of which I have hundreds, of course, is Laurie Anderson, who was married to Lou Reed.
Mm-hmm. Superman.
Exactly. That was the one that all the comic fans know her for.
Mm.
yeah. And her only single.
Mm.
But she, as a performing artist, did a lot of narrative as well as singing and such. And she came up with this wonderful line on one of her albums where she says, when my father died, it was like an entire library had burnt down.
Yes.
And, oh, that is so profound.
Yeah.
And it's true. We all have stories. Some are funnier than others, but we all have stories. And I've been very lucky, really, because I've worked with the gods of Hammer Films, Tom Baker. It is a list, but I don't want to stop and show
before
off.
Before you get to your entire comics gang, we were all, it's like the who's who of the greatest names in comics.
Yes. Mm. And I got to know all the American comics gods, because when you get invited to European conventions, there's only about six of you who speak English. So Jack Kirby treated me as an equal. Neil Adams played a practical joke on me in Lucca, in Italy. Jim Steranko suggested we should go out for a drink because it would be more interesting in the bars than it was at the convention. Ah, wow! I'm so lucky and honoured in that respect. So I eventually thought, well, maybe I should do a book. Maybe I should write this down, because when my father died, it felt like an entire library had burnt down. Well, I'm going to fill that library.
Is it right?
See, that was definitely a paragraph ending. Did you notice? That was a end of chapter.
That was a thing. And to bring it full circle, you know, there would be no Cutaway Comics without Des. And we work with him as well. So Des now is doing the graphic novel collections for us, putting his own stamp on it. From restoring the John Ridgway Omega art to its exquisite black and white simplicity, through to the Demon of Eden, Doctor Who Weekly homage with transfers. It's great, you know, and you know, we live in a really horrible, ageist society in many ways, and Des is still at the top of his game as far as I'm concerned.
So is John Ridgway, by the way.
So is 80. John.
John is 80 years
never
old.
Never misses a chance to tell you he's 80. And yet, he spends his afternoons riding horses.
Yes.
He's an active, fit man. He still can hold that pen and knock out an exquisite page.
Because it is interesting, you find that there are some artists who, after a certain age, I don't know what age that is, they lose the plot.
Mm.
Well, it's a physical business.
Mm.
Drawing,
it is,
isn't it?
Of course it is. It's the eye to hand contact and all that. And I've seen American artists in particular just lose it completely. And there was a guy who I adored when I was a kid called Carmine Infantino.
He drew
The Flash.
And those crazy Star Wars strips.
Well, that's where I'm going. Yeah. He keeps doing this, you know. And he did Mister in Space with Adam Strange, these lovely sci-fi landscapes. And when I got into doing Marvel comics, I looked at Star Wars Weekly and I thought, Marvel has a license for Star Wars Weekly, and they put these absolutely awful cartoon covers on them, which were by Carlo Argentino, who by the age of 60 or whatever he was by then had forgotten how to draw, basically. They didn't look like any of the actors. This could have been a licensing problem. I don't know. American law is different to English law. But I thought, put a photograph on the cover. I've made a career out of doing the obvious. I always maintain that it was obvious to do the Doctor Who magazine, so you brought that back in. It was obvious to do House of Hammer. It was obvious to do a science fiction magazine when Star Wars was about to open. It was obvious to give creators ownership when corporate was taking ownership from them and capitalising on their ideas. I said, let's start a title that you guys own. And so we got V for Vendetta out of that, which I still get royalties on, because I took 10% even though they had ownership. And I get a penny per mask.
Oh, well, the ones used by Anonymous.
Yeah. Yes.
The revolution has been monetized.
Yes.
And Des is making a buck of it.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's great.
So Des and Dave Lloyd get a coin.
Yes. Alan Moore, of course, rose above it.
He gave his share away.
Yes, of course. He didn't want to be involved. I get a penny a mask. So basically, when Anonymous do the Million Mask March every November, I sit there with my calculator. Don't take too long to figure out what a million pennies are, though. But sadly, they're not all official licensed masks.
Indeed.
Some people have ripped off Warner Brothers for the sake of Anonymous. Isn't that deplorable?
I can't believe that.
They're like anarchists, fair to say.
I've got no regard for rules.
Capitalism?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, the underpinning.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, it is also more than a little bit to the Wizard and Chips Guy Fawkes mask, isn't it?
Oh, indeed.
Every year.
I went to this pub in York. I love York. It's the saving grace of Yorkshire. And I was up there with my miniaturised family, my partner and daughter. And we saw a pub in front of us called The Guy Fawkes, with the V for Vendetta mask hanging outside, swinging. And we went in, and I said to the barman, you do realise that that's not actually Guy Fawkes, don't you? And he goes, what? I didn't have a clue. But our image has totally replaced the Catholic arsonist.
Didn't Coke do it with Father Christmas? You know, the Father Christmas.
Yes.
He was originally in a green suit, wasn't he, I think? Mm-hmm. He's now in red because of Coke.
Santa Claus is originally
a scary German fella.
Yeah. The image of Santa Claus is the guy, not in the long gown, but in the sort of big red trousers, black boots, and a red jacket. He's entirely Coke-driven, isn't it?
Yeah.
By Coke's advertising in the...
Smart buggers.
But what you were saying about... I thought you said you went to that pub to demand your royalties.
I want a penny of every pint. Get your calculator out.
So what's happening, the latest things with because we're comics here.
Okay.
Gareth?
Well, we have just finished the Kickstarter for Gods and Monsters 1. So that's Gods and Monsters is an epic 14-part series, which I can't believe I've been stupid enough to commission, but I have. So the first four books... there's a two-part series called Faustine, which is a sequel to... It takes elements of Laurier's Gate. It's written by Steve Gallagher, art by Martin Geraghty. Really lovely. There's a one-shot about Omega, which ties into the wider plot. John Ridgway again, back on the big Omega duties. He's nearly finished, actually. And Mark Griffiths. And then there's a one-shot of Sutek, who is, of course, the Egyptian god of death. From the worlds of Egyptian mythology. And so that's book one. And then we'll be moving into the second part, which is a three-parter with Drax and Eldrad, and a one-shot with Iris Wildtime, which Katie Manning signed off on all the designs. She's getting to a point where she's happy with that. So that's that book. And then the final book is going to be a six-parter. So it's our take on the Marvel comic universe, where, you know, we're throwing all of this IP together into one big, epic, smorgasbord adventure, which is going to take an age to complete. But we'll be very satisfied when it's done. So we have that. We've still got the Happiness Patrol on the slate. We've got a Inferno two-part prequel, which will then go into a full series written by Gary Russell, art by Martin Geraghty, which looks at that whole alternate Earth. But when the Doctor said this Earth only has 3 weeks, he was wrong. They've stabilised it, but it's not a great place to be. Primords rampaging through the countryside, right. People scrabbling for resources. And my brief to Gary has been, destroy that world horribly over 4 seasons. Show us the whole world, show us China, show us Soviet Germany, show us all these horrible places as they choke on fumes and scrabble for supplies and influence and survival and domination. It's going to be a lot of fun seeing that world fall to bits.
And the most shocking news that there's almost within a year of the last one coming out, there's a new warp.
Indeed.
It's almost a hectic schedule for warp.
Well,
warp,
we
it?
Are breaking our traditional 5-year publishing cycle, trademarked 5-year cycle, and I think, touch wood, you'll have one by the end. You'll have issue 5 by the end of this year, because we'd originally banked a lot of stuff, because the original plan for issue 4 was to do some TV comic stuff and some other stuff, and the other stuff was broadly done. And then I said, no, let's give everyone a treat and get all that TV comic stuff in one volume. And we did. But that means that more than half of 5 is already done. So I wouldn't be surprised if we get it for the end of the year. We're still thinking about the free gift. I am thinking I would like to do Y fronts, but we are looking at the practicality of this. But we'll see.
Well, this has been huge fun thing. When this, I see if we can get to talk to Dead Skin. I was thinking, I've heard of Dead Skin. He'll clearly be far too elevated and highfalutin for us to speak to. It turns out scary, yes, but not in the least, but intimidating.
Scary, that's an interesting word. The last time I was described as scary was by BBC Enterprise when they gave me the license to Doctor Who Weekly. Roy Williams admitted over a gin and tonic a few months later. That you've been scared of me. I think it's my Yorkshire upbringing, you know.
Blunt
and bluff.
The only scary person I ever met was Terry Pratchett, where he was backstage at one of the
Sci-Fi Weekenders.
And I went, I just said, I know he wasn't very well, but he had this, it felt like, I went to speak to him, I said, you know, Mr. Pratchett, lovely to meet you. Oh, you're having a good weekend. Wonderful books, you know. And he looked at me like lasers just pierced through him, as if to say, who are you and are you worth talking to? And I felt I'd failed the test after a 20-minute laser burst. And then I recovered it, and I said, it was a very moving documentary about your struggle with dementia and how you continue to work. So my partner at the time worked as a dementia nurse, so I was able to talk with a bit of confidence about dementia. So I got 3 minutes of his attention, and then he switched off. He literally switched off and just turned away and spoke to someone else. And I thought, okay.
There you go, a bit of character assassination via the podcast.
So there we go. So nothing can be as scary as 3 minutes with Terry Pratchett.
And it's also been wonderful to finally meet Gareth in person, whereas it's been nice to see that Des isn't quite as scary as we imagined it were, he would be. It's slightly disappointing that you aren't as scary and above it all as we thought you might be, Gareth.
None of us do scary. We play nicely. Because that's the only way.
Well, we shall put all the links to Cutaways and Des's publications and the talks about in the show
Des's
notes.
Des's excellent website, which is...
And Des's excellent website. Yeah.
Which has been buggered up by WordPress.
You can get onto it, it's just that you have to bypass your own computer's safety protocols or something.
Your certificate is out of date.
You see, This is why I'm doing the books.
Well,
because I just don't trust the internet.
Well, no, it can disappear.
It can disappear.
And then that's all your stuff.
Life has gone. It's the library that's burnt
down. Well, it's the same with buying comics, the same with buying DVDs, buying CDs even.
Tangible.
Stuff. It's, yeah. It's
they things can't suddenly delist it.
No. If you love it, own it. Buy it. Hold it.
Well, I think that Michael Jackson episode of The Simpsons is not available online.
It is
Des with a Z, skin with two N.com.
And it's
cutawaycomics.co.uk.
Brilliant. Thanks, chaps.
Thank you. It's been a thrill.
Stop.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum. The empty space that circles dime. I mean, time, Jesterton.